Hello, I'm Julia Baird. Welcome to Sunday Profile. In the 1950s, Noam Chomsky caused an enormous stir in the Global Academy when he became the first linguist to argue that the human brain has an innate and unique capacity for language. This idea revolutionised the way we view language and, you could say, the very foundation of thought. Today, Professor Chomsky, who's been a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for 55 years, is a revolutionary of a different kind. He's become the world's most famous left-wing intellectual, dissident, and activist. The New York Times called him arguably the most important intellectual alive. But Professor Chomsky is both adored and hated, feted as a fearless firebrand intellectual and vilified as anti-American and anti-Israel. For the past five decades, he's been a persistent critic of American foreign policy, arguing relentlessly that the US is no better, and in fact some ways worse, than the evil empires, rogue regimes and terrorists it fights. In the US, he is almost invisible in the mainstream media. But in the rest of the world, he's a superstar. U2's Bono calls him the Elvis of academia. This year, somewhat controversially, he's been awarded the Sydney Peace Prize. He flew here this week to accept it in person. Professor Chomsky joined us on Sunday Profile and began by explaining how he sees Australia's place in the world.
Australia is one of the, today is one of the very few countries that sometimes votes along with the United States on Israel-Palestine issues. If you look at votes at the General Assembly, the United States is almost totally isolated. The votes are the United States, Israel, maybe a Pacific island. But in the last roughly 10 years, also Australia sometimes, it comes along. There are plenty of refugees flooding to Australia. It's a wealthy country, so it attracts victims of violence and oppression elsewhere. It's kind of a mixed record. Australia hasn't been hospitable to them, as I think it should be. The same is true of the rest of the Western world, the United States, Europe, too.
Now, I am very interested in what you think Australia's alliance with the US means for our standing in geopolitics, or means kind of what we do globally. Because obviously we've fought alongside them in every conflict almost over the last century. I mean, it's not just been Vietnam, and most recently, and critically, Iraq and Afghanistan. Our former Prime Minister John Howard said we should think of ourselves as a US deputy sheriff. George Bush said no, we should make that sheriff. I mean, what does that mean? If you call the US a leading terrorist state, what implications does that have for Australia?
Well, I call the US a leading terrorist state because when I write about terrorism, as I've done extensively since 1981, important year. That's when Ronald Reagan came into office and declared a global war on terror. So I started writing about it. What I write about it has a major flaw. I keep to the official U.S. code, British law, army manuals, and by now the U.N. Security Council and General Assembly definitions of terror. And if you use those definitions of terror, and you pay the slightest attention to perfectly uncontroversial facts about the world, it follows immediately that the U.S. is a leading terrorist state. And Australia, by its, if you like, deputy sheriff role, is hence a secondary participant in serious acts of terror, but much more, terror is a serious crime, but there's a much more severe crime, the supreme international crime, as it was called at the Nuremberg tribunals, namely the crime of aggression. And the cases you mentioned, certainly Vietnam and unquestionably Iraq, you can argue about Afghanistan, though I would add that too. These are crimes of aggression. And yes, Australia is a participant, so it therefore shares some of the responsibility for the often quite horrendous consequences.
So what does that mean? I mean, you talk often about these standards of the Nuremberg tribunals, and say that you've said that if George Bush were to be judged by these standards, he would be hanged. What do those standards mean for what you call a secondary participant? What if Australia were hauled up to talk about Iraq?
Well, you can ask yourself, what would we say about Hungarian participation in Nazi crimes? They weren't the Nazis, but they supported them. So did others. If that's the way Australia wants itself to be perceived and, in fact, to act in the world, that's a choice one should think about what the company are keeping.
But clearly there are strong strategic reasons for Australia to be closely allied to the U.S. as well.
Yeah, there are strategic reasons for communist parties in Eastern Europe to be allied to the Soviet Communist Party. It doesn't absolve them of what they did. There are strategic reasons. There are also choices. There's no law of nature that, say, required Australia to send troops to take part in the U.S. attack against South Vietnam or the invasion of Iraq and so on.
Well, what about our current situation? Our Prime Minister Julia Gillard has said we must stay the course in Afghanistan, where we have 1,500 troops, because she said we do not want Afghanistan to be a safe haven for terrorists to train and then come and take Australian lives in terrorist incidents. What's your response to that, and what do you think our responsibilities are in Afghanistan?
The idea that the U.S. and Australia are in Afghanistan to reduce the threat of terror is pretty hard to sustain. One of the consequences of the invasion of Afghanistan, and even more so the invasion of Iraq, was to greatly increase the threat of terror. That's hardly in question. In the case of Afghanistan, there's a lot to say. Right after 9/11, there were alternatives. The one alternative was to invade Afghanistan. And remember, the invasion was not carried out, even officially, for the benefit of Afghans. It wasn't to drive out the Taliban. That was an afterthought a couple of weeks later. The invasion was carried out because the Taliban governing authorities refused to turn over to the United States the prime suspect for the 9/11 attacks, namely Osama bin Laden. The U.S. demanded that he be turned over. The Taliban asked for evidence that he'd been involved. The U.S. refused to provide any evidence. We later found out why. They really didn't have any, as was conceded. The Taliban made some tentative offers, which might have been serious, might not have been, we don't know, to have Osama bin Laden tried in some fashion independently of Taliban control. It could have been explored. It wasn't. The U.S. and its allies preferred the bomb. In fact, just recently, the United Nations reported that the violence in Afghanistan is the worst that it's been in 10 years. There were other options as well. The jihadi movement did not support 9/11. In fact, it was very critical of it. Much of it was. Fatwas denouncing it, leading clerics, other leaders condemning the 9/11 attack. I think it was then moderately clear. I think it's become much more clear since we've gotten more evidence that a possibility at that time was to isolate bin Laden from his own supporters and also from the general Muslim community that he was trying to reach out to. Remember, terrorists are a vanguard. They're trying to stimulate others to join them. And bin Laden had a message. He was trying to organize the Muslim world around these several things, but one of them was the slogan that the U.S. is leading a crusade against Islam. Well, the U.S. Accepted his message and acted that way, and in fact, that helped mobilize the Muslim world around Osama's campaign. By now, 10 years later, a very large part of the Muslim world sees the United States as leading an attack against Islam. There was an alternative.
You're on Sunday Profile with me, Julia Baird, and I'm talking to Professor Noam Chomsky, author, linguist, activist, and winner of the 2011 Peace Prize in Sydney. Professor Chomsky, do you think there will be peace in the Middle East?
Well, if you mean Israel-Palestine,
yes.
It's one of the simplest problems to solve in world affairs. In fact, there has been an overwhelming international consensus for close to 35 years, by now it includes essentially everyone, on the basic terms of a solution. It's blocked for one reason. The United States will not permit it. For 35 years, the United States has been barring diplomatic settlement, which has overwhelming support. 35 years ago, the U.S. vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement on the international border with recognition of the rights of every state in the region to exist in peace and security. It's famous wording of UN 242. The resolution was brought by the Arab confrontation states, as they were called, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. Israel refused to attend the session. The United States vetoed it. It essentially continues like that with rare few exceptions.
What would it take then in the case of the Middle East, or of Israel and Palestine? If you're talking about a few simple words, what will break the gridlock that you're talking about?
The U.S. should simply announce that it will no longer support criminal acts, which is what they were, in the occupied territories. It will not support the Israeli army, the IDF, in occupying the territories or maintaining the very brutal siege of Gaza. It will not pay for settlements, which it does. And it will inform Israel that this is finished. You have to accept the political settlement. And I think they would do it. What will bring the United States to that? And pretty much the same kinds of circumstances that led to the Indonesian case, and it's not the only one, there are others. Internal pressure, which is critical. Already the large majority of the population supports the international consensus and has for some years, so that's one. And external pressure, including from Australia and England and Europe.
Professor Chomsky, I'm interested in something you've spoken about a lot that seems to have excited you a lot more lately. If I can just change tack slightly for a moment.
Yeah.
In recent days, you have praised demonstrators on Wall Street as courageous and honourable. Why do you believe the Occupy Wall Street movement, which has spread to now hundreds of countries worldwide in various forms, why do you believe this movement is an important one?
It's the first really large-scale movement of people dedicated to trying to reverse extremely destructive policies that have been undertaken in the wealthy countries for the last 30 years, which are variants of policies that have been imposed on much of the third world, the devastating effect. But these are concentrating on what it did at home. In the 1970s, the economy underwent a significant change towards financialization, increase in the role of speculative capital, financial institutions, and so on. During the growth period of the big high growth period of the 50s and the 60s, banks were banks. They did what banks are supposed to do in a capitalist or state capitalist economy. In the 70s, that changed. They moved towards risky financial transactions, complicated financial instruments, and grew enormously in power. By 2007, when this reached a peak, the financial institutions of the United States had about 40% of corporate profits. Well, this is has partially market characteristics, so it's very risky. And, of course, beginning in the Reagan years, when it really expanded rapidly, there were constant crashes, each one worse than the last, the worst one we've just been through, and there may be worse to come. Each time the government moved in to protect the culprits and bail them out. The earlier crises, like the savings and loan crisis, at least there were people brought to justice, sent to jail, and so on. This time, almost nothing. So what we have is a regular cycle escalating of risky and hence lucrative transactions, which are almost guaranteed to lead to a crisis. When the crisis comes and the system collapses, the taxpayer stays in and steps in and bail them out. Meanwhile, wealth has concentrated enormously. So in the United States, everyone knows it's unequal, but what's not too well known is that the inequality is largely determined by a tiny fraction of the population, actually about a tenth of 1%, which has become spectacularly wealthy. That's hedge fund managers, CEOs, others who do nothing for the economy, they probably harm it, but have gained enormous wealth through these transactions. Concentration of wealth leads to concentration of political power, and they have used that political power to introduce legislation which escalates the vicious cycle. Deregulation, fiscal measures like taxation, rules of corporate governance, others, which have escalated this cycle. For the past 30 years, for the majority of the population, real incomes have pretty much stagnated, often declined. With the last crash of the housing bubble, people have been getting by debt, asset inflation, higher hours of work, and so on. People don't live by third world standards, but compared with what ought to exist in a rich country, now there's a popular reaction to it for the first time, and a very significant one.
It's not just a popular protest. It appears to be a mainstream protest, a group of people that would normally be dismissed as what Australians would call rat bags. Suddenly, 54% of the country approves of what they're doing, according to an October 11 poll. I mean, you must find that quite, cheering.
I think it's a reflection of an understanding among the general public that the system is completely crashed as far as they're concerned. If you look at attitudes towards institutions, I don't think they've ever been anywhere near, approval has never been anywhere near this low. Approval of Congress is literally in single digits. About two-thirds of the population think that Congress ought to be just dismissed, get rid of it. Approval of the presidency is also not historically low, but rather low. Hatred of banks and corporations is, again, very high. Just about everywhere you look, there's skepticism, disapproval, people have suffered. The policies that the public wants are almost diametrically opposed to the policies being pursued by the two political parties. So take the major issue in Washington has been the deficit. When you ask about public attitudes, they're concerned correctly about unemployment, joblessness, not about the deficit, and they're right. So yes, it's not surprising that you get support for protests against things that people really regard as a severe attack on their elementary rights and what they ought to have in the world.
I'd like to ask you a personal question, if I might. Now, you're about to hop on a plane for a long flight to Australia. Usually you would travel with your wife, Carol, who unfortunately passed away a short time ago. And this is the side of you we don't hear about much, the devoted father, you're a grandfather, and you were married to the same woman for 60-odd years. What is it that spending a lifetime with Carol taught you?
Well, we were actually pretty private people. We had a couple of friends. But mainly it was life by ourselves with the family. If we had free time, we'd always have preferred to spend it together rather than something else. And it was 60 years. We were married very young. In fact, I can now understand why our parents thought we were out of our minds. When my children reached that age, the idea of them getting married seemed outlandish. Carol was just turned 19. I was 20. But ups and downs as always, but it worked. We were very close. About 5 years ago, Carol got severely ill. She suddenly turned out she had incurable cancer, brain and lung cancer. And for the next 2 years, I did virtually nothing. She needed full-time care, and I basically stayed with her, didn't travel at all, and took care of her as she declined. We managed, it was difficult as you can imagine, but we managed with my children to arrange it so that she could stay at home, finally die at home 3 years ago. After that, I kind of dropped out for a while and then went back to intensive work. But we kept it to ourselves at the time, and I keep my life private now.
Is that what has enabled you to have the extraordinary output that you do? Your work as a linguist, as a scholar, as an activist, a speaker, flying around the world? Was it really her love and support that enabled you to do that?
It certainly was a large part of it. In fact, the support was There was a time in the 1960s, late 1960s, after years when I'd been quite very active in the anti-war movement, and I was involved in resistance. In fact, I was in and out of jail, and actually I was coming up for trial, federal trial, and might very well have spent several years in jail. The trials were aborted by the Tet Offensive in January 68, which led the government to call off the trials. But at that point, Carol hadn't been in college for about 15 years. She went back to get a PhD. I think she was a 17th-year graduate student at Harvard when she got it. And the main reason was we had three children, and somebody was going to have to support the children. Well, that was just taken as routine. That's the way we lived. She had to live with quite a lot, I should say, many things, but it was never a problem between us. It was just a mutually supportive relationship. My oldest daughter, one of her childhood memories is Carol and I were both arrested at a demonstration at the same time once, and you know, you get one phone call. So Carol called my oldest daughter, who was then, I think, 12, and asked her if she would, told her, "We're not coming home tonight, we're in jail. Could you take care of the two younger children?" And she said, "Oh, sure, no problem." You know, she took care of the two kids. In fact, the first time I was arrested, she was in first grade. And when I came home, you know, Carol and I talked about it, and she told me that my daughter went, they have what I don't what they call show and tell. The beginning of the class, the kids tell the class something interesting. And she told me that our daughter came home, and at show and tell, she told the class that proudly my father's in jail. You know, that's what she grew up with. She's now quite an effective activist herself and a very good scholar, too.
When you were talking about Wall Street, you used the term a precariat, which is a group of people in a vulnerable kind of global economy seeking to survive in a somewhat precarious existence. And when looking at people like yourselves, I mean, you've been a professor at MIT for 55 years. You've been involved in global world politics for the better part of four decades and have seen so much change and yet so much remain the same. There's a precariat of its own, which is kind of the swinging between hope and despair and trying to engage and fearing that nothing will ever change. What is it that compels you to keep going, and what is it that gives you hope?
I could give many examples, but to give one that's close to what we've been talking about, for years I had a picture on my desk of a young Timorese girl, about the age of my own daughters, and I looked at it every morning and felt it looked like a hopeless situation at the time. For many years it looked totally hopeless. But finally, you know, after huge slaughter and destruction, something happened, and it had success. And it's not the only case. We really have two choices. We can decide to be pessimistic, decide nothing's possible, and quit and help guarantee that the world will happen. Or we can put in whatever effort we can as individuals to try to improve things, and maybe it'll make the world better. And it often does. That's not much of a choice.
Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Author, activist, and linguist Professor Noam Chomsky on Sunday Profile with me, Julia Baird. You can find this interview on abc.net.au/rn/Sunday Profile. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to producer Irene Ullman. Talk to you next week. Coming up next on ABC Radio National, Rear Vision.